You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. With growing attention focused on the Bush administration's failure to locate Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction, the president's principal justification for war, Congress and the media are beginning to ask some tough questions about the possible exaggeration or manipulation of information gathered by intelligence agencies. Against this backdrop, armed resistance to the U.S. military occupation of Iraq is becoming more deadly with each passing day, and ambushes by guerrilla forces against U.S. troops are almost a daily occurrence. The U.S. has responded by sending thousands of troops into conflicted areas and conducting aggressive house-to-house searches for weapons, tactics which have angered many anti-Saddam civilians who increasingly resent the occupation of their nation. The killing of 18 unarmed protesters by U.S. soldiers in the city of Fallujah last month has also fanned the flames of hostility and sparked a cry for revenge. In all, CNN is reporting that some 61 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq since Bush announced the official end of the war on May 1st, and many of those casualties are a result of hostile fire. Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines spoke recently with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report. Tenzing examined the growing armed resistance in Iraq and the possibility that the increasing number of guerrilla attacks could signal the beginning of a protracted conflict.
Who is the resistance? I don't have an authoritative answer on that. I do have some reason to believe from, you know, eyewitness reports from reliable Iraqi sources that there are some members of the old Republican Guard and even the old security services who have been agitating and have been participating in some of these demonstrations of crowds, such as the one in Fallujah that led to the shooting of unarmed protesters. But I think it's very unlikely that every Iraqi who's involved in either those unarmed demonstrations or the armed attacks on U.S. soldiers is an ex-Ba'athist or an ex-supporter of Saddam Hussein's regime. It's more likely that what we see in this area, predominantly Sunni areas northwest of Baghdad, is the U.S. operating in an area which was the social base of support for Saddam Hussein's regime, not necessarily because they bought his ideology and were apologists for him, but because they were recipients of disproportionately good treatment, both in terms of the services provided by the state and in terms of job opportunities and all of those things for social promotion of the people in that area, and that they fear loss in status in post-war Iraq to the other elements in Iraq, particularly the Shia population, that appears to have keeping lines open to the occupation authorities. I think some of the resistance also simply comes from a sense of Iraqi nationalism. While they may have been happy to see Saddam Hussein's regime fall and are happy that he's no longer governing them, even if he is still alive in Iraq, they're not happy at all about an indefinite foreign occupation of their country, especially not if the occupying force is going to employ rather heavy-handed tactics to put down any and all expressions of dissent and resistance. You know, certainly, I think the more heavy-handed the tactics become, house-to-house searches of houses with absolutely no reason to believe that there's anyone inside who poses a threat to the U.S. forces, these types of measures are likely to engender the kind of resentment toward U.S. forces that eventually we may be able to compare to Palestinian resentment toward Israeli occupying forces, the kind of pan-Iraqi resentment of the occupation that could, in the future, boil over into a genuine social intifada against a U.S. occupation. I think it's way too early to say that that's happening. It would take a long time for such a thing to develop, but it's possible that that could happen, particularly if the United States does not make some positive progress on these questions of indigenous governance, and particularly the questions of providing basic security and basic amenities to the population. All of these omens are not good, and I would say the chances are pretty high that it will turn into what can be called a quagmire.
The Bush administration seems to have gone out of its way in recent weeks to label those elements of armed resistance in Iraq attacking U.S. troops as terrorists or specifically as sympathetic to al-Qaeda, and despite the fact that there's no evidence or direct connection between Saddam Hussein's old government and Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, the group that carried out the attack against the United States on September 11th, is it possible that the Bush administration is setting up a justification to increase the level of troops in Iraq to combat an insurgency that may develop later and be able to sell that to the American public by labeling any future fight around the U.S. occupation of Iraq as a fight against terrorism?
That's certainly possible. And I agree with the premise of your question. And we saw this during the war as well, that virtually any acts of resistance against the invading forces are to be labeled death squads, terrorism, these very inflammatory labels, which probably distort the reality on the ground. Paul Bremer is now freely using the word occupation to describe the U.S. presence in Iraq when we heard constantly before the war that we are not coming as your occupiers, we're coming as your liberators. All of this rhetoric has suddenly been thrown down the memory hole, but not down the memory hole of Iraqis. I think that one reason why the administration has put so much focus on, quote, foreign fighters who may have links to Osama bin Laden or God knows who else is that leaves open, talking about Sunni militants leaves open the prospect of blaming things on Syria. Talking about the influence of Iran on the Shia religious parties leaves open the possibility of blaming unrest in Iraq among the Iraqi population upon Iranian meddling. And it provides a pretext, which probably would be one of many, for more vigorous intervention in Iran than is currently taking place. So, in that regard, the unrest in Iraq could, paradoxically enough, even though it should be taken as evidence of the failure of the strategic vision of the neoconservatives who are probably still driving Middle East policy in the Bush administration, it will be taken as evidence that we simply haven't finished yet.
Chris Tensing is the editor of the Middle East Report. He spoke with Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines.
I was talking to my assistant a couple months back, and while we were talking about the obvious differences in men and women, I had to give up and say that men couldn't handle the period cycle that women go through. She countered and told me that men do have periods. They're called wars. Across 40 countries in the world, I can attest to the fact that the common peoples on the earth have long suffered and swallowed the bullet of the greed of governmental rule and arrogance. Power is a funny thing when born of the few individuals that are selected to govern people, no matter where they're at on the earth. It makes manipulation a close cousin. Mad questions abound. Whoever the so-called hijackers of planet is answered to, my question is, how come their superiors didn't put their lives on the line? I don't buy religious martyrdom if the leader heads themselves can't get in the same box. It's problematic when one is trained and taught to die for religious elevation, while the heads of that structure are rich as hell and don't share the wealth with their followers. On the other side, the United States is talking war, but who is actually going to fight those battles and with whom? War is not a football game, y'all. Bush and the rest of these 50-plus white men, seek power included, will not be on the air or field. They will not be on the air or field. They're making definite decisions, and I have a problem with the arrogance of most governments, period.
A Twisted Sense of God, Part 1, by the Fine Arts Militia, featuring Chuck D. There's been much discussion about the role journalism plays in ensuring Americans' civil liberties. In countries where journalists face censorship and imprisonment, it is the novelist, playwright, or poet who creates the climate of reform and who challenges the status quo. In this week's edition of A Clear and Present Danger, Pacifica's series exploring the challenges of free expression in an open society, Stephen Rohde discusses with authors Amy Liu and Henry Brummell the critical role fiction plays in interpreting American democracy.
Today I'm speaking with Amy Liu, author most recently of Flash House, and Henry Brummell, author of Little America. These books have something in common. They both deal with the CIA's activities during the Cold War. Flash House describes the U.S. attempts to create a third force to fight communism in Western China as early as 1948, and Little America describes a CIA plot to assassinate the ruler of a small Middle Eastern kingdom in the 1950s. We've asked Amy and Henry to discuss with us today the role that fiction plays in the American political dialogue, and as an extension of that, in civil liberties. Across the globe, novelists, playwrights, and poets are deeply engaged in politics and at times emerging democracies. One need only look to Vaclav Havel, Mario Vargas Llosa, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn. If nonfiction informs us of facts, fiction, it seems to me, informs us in a different but equally important way. Among many examples, I'm thinking of Graham Greene's The Quiet American and his interpretation of the American experience in Vietnam. Amy, what do you think is the role that fiction can play in current political debates?
Well, I think your example of The Quiet American is an excellent point. Much of what we know about Vietnam dates back to The Quiet American. Millions of people who don't read history books have read The Quiet American, and they get the point of American meddling in Southeast Asia because of that novel. And I think at any point in time, there are a large percentage of readers don't read history books. They don't read nonfiction. They may not even read the newspaper, but they read novels. And so if you don't put political information into that realm, then you're missing a huge part of the population. I also think that fiction has a way of getting into the story. So it takes the reader to a much more personal connection with the information than most nonfiction.
Henry, when you set out to write your novel, were you intent on making a political point? Were you telling a good story, or both?
Both. I was trying to come up with a story that would pull together all the things I knew about living inside the American ghetto, Little America, in the 50s. And also what the dads were doing every day when they drove away in their Chevys to work at the various embassies. It never would occur to me to write – personally to write that book as a piece of nonfiction. You know, for me, it's really – it is the story and the characters. But I agree. What it allows, like Quiet American or Man's Fate – I mean, we could list a long list of great novels about what are essentially political situations. But you read them first and foremost, the good ones like those. You know, to enter that story and to enter that fictional world, if it later turns out that you learn something about politics, as we all did in Vietnam because of Quiet American, then more, you know, that's better.
Also, there's allegory in stories, which is rarely there in nonfiction. And so if you're using allegory in a novel, you reach a different kind of truth than you do in nonfiction, in journalism, or in history books.
We've had to reach back to The Quiet American for a good example of all this. I mean, we had a time when John Dos Passos and Upton Sinclair were powerfully influencing the American scene through their nonfiction, and then a period with Norman Mailer and some other examples. Do you feel today fiction is as powerful an influence in awakening minds on social and political and religious and economic issues as it was in earlier times, Henry?
Fiction isn't as powerful in any way as it was. The kind of fiction you're talking about from largely the 20s and the 30s, and which comes out of a sort of a political commitment, a movement that was going on in this country. You know, those were the same places that much of the great folk singing came out of a little later in the 30s and 40s. I think we all have to be sort of realistic about what any novel can achieve, especially today. So if I were trying to primarily move a political point, I would probably choose other ways to do it.
I think a big part of the problem is the marketplace and the audience for books today. At the risk of being unpopular on this show, I think there may have been – we may be spoiled by free speech for so long to a certain degree. And what I mean by that is the population has become so literal-minded because anything is possible. You can say anything. You can see anything. And so the majority of people in this country, I think, have become so accustomed to just being able to hear exactly what someone is thinking those layers of metaphor that used to make reading so rich is wasted on a lot of people in this country today. I mean, we're used to turning on MTV and seeing, you know, naked women. We don't have to imagine naked women anymore. So in writing, the writing has become considerably less subtle. And when you write a novel like Henry's novel and my novel that does have layers of subtlety and complexity, people are not as receptive to it as I think they may have been in prior generations, when more had to be in code.
Henry, Little America is not flattering toward the CIA. Were you concerned about the public reaction to your work?
No, that never occurred to me. No, the only thing I was concerned about was trying to get it right and, you know, feeling that when I got to the end of it, that no cheap shots were being taken. Because since I grew up in that world, I can't help but know, you know, so many of the people who were involved and whom I liked and still do. So, no, I sort of think of it as a love poem for the CIA, to be honest. So I don't even see it as being that critical.
But, did you begin writing it before 9/11?
Yeah, I did. In fact, Joan Didion sent me a letter. She read it. And she said she finished it the night before 9/11 and that for several days thereafter, she felt this weird feeling that she was living in some kind of extension of the novel because, of course, it's the same groups.
Amy, do novelists and poets and playwrights, the creators of fiction, have any role in defending and advancing our civil liberties and our freedom of speech?
I think they play a critical role, especially when our civil liberties are taken away from us. Certainly in authoritarian governments, countries like China and the Soviet Union, a great deal of political information was conveyed through fiction and through poetry because it couldn't be said directly. It couldn't be said in the literal terms that we have become so accustomed to here. One of my great worries in looking at this subject and thinking about it now is that, again, like I say, we've become so spoiled by free speech that as our civil liberties are shut down, people in this country may not have the skills to read between the lines. And that is a very scary thought. It means that people will not have the ability to send and receive the coded messages, if you will, that we may need to get around the shutdown of civil liberties.
Henry, do you agree with that? Do you think novelists and poets and others, creators of fiction, bear a special responsibility when it comes to freedom of expression?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, their work is that freedom of expression, literally. And so even if it's not antagonistic toward anybody particularly, it just is by being. And the better the writer, usually, the sort of more unique the writer. And for, you know, often many good writers have to go a long time before they find their audience for that very reason. So that's all – every act of writing, I think, is an act of free speech.
What I've been observing is that the American society today isn't experiencing censorship in the heavy heel of government banning books. We don't have that form of censorship. But do we have a censorship of the market?
Absolutely.
How is that?
Well, the controllers of the mass market chains are now very concerned about not offending conservative values. And so they are actively censoring what these stores carry in many respects. They want Christian values. They don't want anything that is likely to offend their customers. And so they are literally bouncing out books that have racy covers or that seem to contain any material that might not conform to the conservative values. And that is really chilling.
But are we wrong to measure the entire debate by books? I mean, Eminem may be a voice that for a lot of people
you're absolutely right.
Is there was honest, genuine,
yes,
hard-hitting,
absolutely.
Realistic, and yes. It comes in the form of music.
There was an article in, I think, the New York Times Magazine about two rappers. Whatever I look at it, I realize how strong and powerful this thing is. Both these guys were from projects somewhere, and they were being asked things, well, why do you use dirty language and why do you talk about violence so much? And they said, because that's what we know. Then the worried question was, well, why is this connecting to so many people? And these guys said, well, there must be some sort of bigger truth to what we're saying.
Amy, we're in the midst of a tumultuous era in terms of the war in Iraq, the peace movement, the assault on civil liberties in America. Are these topics, do you anticipate that there are great American novelists out there or maybe here in the studio who will at some point address those momentous events in our society?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I didn't set out to write an allegory about our invasion of Iraq, but I happen to be writing a book about an expatriate woman, an American who's blinded by good intentions, who attempts to rescue people who don't necessarily want to be rescued on her terms and who then cannot handle the unintended consequences of her actions. That's what Flash House is about. Now, I wrote most of this book well before 9/11. I didn't know that it was going to become an allegory for our times, but that's what happened. And I think in the same way, there are probably plenty of people out there writing books now about today that will be applicable to tomorrow. My real concern is whether there's going to be anybody who will publish those books, particularly if they question Americanism, if they're politically complex, because what I see in much of the book-buying audience and also in the publishing world is a continuing and increasing desire to have good guys and bad guys, to lay things out in a fairly simplistic term, and also to have sympathetic Americans. I'm not sure that there's a huge market, at least in this country, for books that are critical of Americans. And I think right now, perhaps especially, we need to take a critical look at ourselves and how we are perceived by the rest of the world. And Americans are not receptive to that. The whole world is watching us, and more and more and more Americans are not watching anybody else.
I completely agree. And it's really terrible. It's also sort of scary. We are so provincial, and yet we're the biggest kid on the block. So in a way, we're the people who should be the least provincial. It's not just about carrying a big stick. It's about understanding your place in the world, which means you've got to see the rest of the world first.
And if we did more of that, we would understand why they hate us.
Yeah.
We call our program Clear and Present Danger. Henry, what do you think is the most clear and present danger to free expression in America today?
Capitalism. Marketplace, the idea that only those things that appeal to the most people have value or place, the fact that just as small stores are forced out of business, just as whole ways of life are forced out of business, writing can be forced out of business, or certain writers can. They already have been. When you think about the fact that, I don't know what the statistics are, 99% of the, quote, serious novelists in America all make a living spending their lives in the academy. Talk about being relegated to the Ivy Patch.
I'm concerned that the conservative agenda increasingly is going to be shaping the book marketplace. So I would say that to your listeners, Steve, the best thing that they could do is all go out and buy all of their books at independent booksellers rather than the mass markets.
We've been talking with Amy Liu, author of Flash House, and Henry Bromell, author of Little America, both of which are available at your local independent bookshops. Thank you both. This has been a wonderfully provocative and interesting discussion. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
A Clear and Present Danger, Pacifica's series exploring the challenges of free expression in an open society, is a production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones, the producer is Eileen Moskowitz, and the editor is Mark Torres. The show was recorded on location in Los Angeles. To obtain a copy, you can go to www.pacificaradioarchives.org and find out more about PEN USA. You can go to their website at www.penusa.org. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. We had production assistance from Keith Chaljian. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.